Is that coming through okay?
This is part two of the interview with Harold Kerr and Tom Zinn. Harold, let's see, you graduated from the university in 1957.
That's right, Elizabeth, after winter terms. And then I went back for the graduation ceremony with my old college roommate and got to wear the gown and walk through the procession, which I was pretty big thrill for somebody from Lakeview who never thought they'd go to college.
So. And what did you do next then?
Well, I was working for my father and for my parents and on the farm, and they had hinted that I probably ought to be looking for work, so I started making a few inquiries, and everyone I talked to said, well, what's your draft status? And I said, well, as far as I know, I'm still number four on the list. I never got a school deferment, and every time they were about to draft me, somebody'd volunteer for the draft, and so I stayed in the top four or five for all 4 years of college, and as far as I know, I'm still there. And so,
this was during the Korean War?
Yeah, it would have been.
They were being drafted, at least, and there wasn't actually any combat going on when I went in November of 57. But one guy said, well, why don't you just go in and volunteer to go take your physical? Because that was the other part of it. My family doctor had said, you won't have to go in the Army. There's no reason for you to take ROTC. You'll fail the physical because of asthma. And so I had that in the back of my mind, and I told this potential employer that, and he said, why don't you go to Portland and take your physical, and then if you fail it, then, you know, we might be interested in hiring you. So I put my boots in the shoe shop and never did get them back, come to think about it, and wore a pair of moccasins and Levi's and a Levi jacket to Portland to take this physical. Well, by then I'm 22 years old, and I really don't think I told my parents exactly what I was doing. But anyhow, I went up there to volunteer to take my physical, and there were 30 of us there and upstairs in this building, and the sergeant ran us through all these hoops. And after 5 or 6 hours, he came over to me with a stack of papers, and he said, here, these are yours. And I said, what are these? And he said, well, you're in charge of this group. You got to take them to Fort Ord. And I said, no, Sergeant, I don't think so. I said, I'm supposed to fail the physical, and I'm supposed to go back home to Lakeview. And he said, no, he said, we needed 30, and you all pass. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're in charge because you had the best test scores. And I said, well, these guys, I don't know where they all are, but I know where some of them are, and they're pretty drunk, and they're not going to be very controllable. And he said, well, we'll help you get them on the bus and take you out to the airport, and then you're in charge. And I thought, oh, man. So anyhow, we flew to Fort Ord, got in there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and went through all the Army hoops of picking up cigarette butts under the barracks, and went through the getting your shots, and all of a sudden, after I'd been there about 3 days, I realized I should call my folks and tell them I wouldn't be home for 2 years. And so I did, and that's how I got in the Army. And at one point in time, I got a note from a colonel to come over and interview him. And so I went over to this office building and walked in and saluted. And he said, son, we don't salute in this office. And I said, okay, sir, that's fine with me. And he said, we need some people in the vet corps to be food inspectors. He said, we don't have any Army vets anymore, but we still have a vet department. And he said, they're in charge of food inspection. And he said, we'd like to know if you'd consider doing that. And I said, boy, that sounds a lot better than the rumor mill. It says the rest of these guys are going to Fort Bliss, Texas for a second 8 weeks of training and then going to Germany to be a showcase Army outfit, do nothing but parades and whatnot. And I said, boy, this food inspection sounds like a good deal to me. So when we checked out, they all took off for Fort Bliss, Texas, and I caught a plane to New York City and started nearly 2 years of veterinary corps food inspection in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Did they give you any training for that, or were you prepared with your
Well, I was
background?
Pretty well trained from the college background, but they did offer a school for 6 weeks in Chicago, and I signed up for that and still hold the honor, as far as I know, of having the best grades ever received at that vet school. The only question I missed, I'll never forget, they wanted to know what you called the milk that the cows gave right after they calved. And I wrote cholesterol, I think that's right.
What was it?
Clostridium. I probably couldn't spell it, but anyhow, I put that down and they said, no, that's not the right answer. You should have said, it's not milk. And I said, okay. So, you know, that was the only question I missed in the 6 weeks. And I ended up tutoring a bunch of kids that were in there that had no farm background at all and didn't know what a steer was. And the main thing we learned about was quality and grading of beef and cheese and then packaging it so that it could survive overseas shipment and be exposed to salt water and rain and whatnot. And so it was a great school. While I was there, I purchased an engagement ring and went back to New York and I thought I was being really secretive, really sneaky as I met with my girlfriend, proposed to her that night, and from the time she met me at the train depot until I finally got around to proposing, she knew exactly what I was up to because she could see the square box in my pants pocket. So anyhow, didn't surprise her then and haven't surprised her since. She's a New York City, raised in Brooklyn, Polish girl and mother of our two kids. And after the Army, we'll do this and then you can go back to the Army if you want. But anyhow, we got married and April of 59, April of 59. And my goal was always go back to the farm in Lakeview. And so we drove out in November of 59 and in a snowstorm got stranded in Alturas, California and finally got into Lakeview with a foot of snow on the ground, pulling a trailer that my brother had driven back to New York City, so the three of us rode back together and moved into this old farmhouse that my folks had moved out of into a much nicer home. And there was a pack rat nest in the middle of the couch, and the place hadn't been swept or heated or anything for a couple of years. It's pretty bad shape. But the story I wanted to tell was one morning after we'd kind of got pretty well fixed up in there, Carol got up first because we had to build a stove to heat water so we had hot water, build a fire in the stove so we had hot water. And she went out to the kitchen to start the fire and screamed. And I thought, what in the world? So I rushed out to see what the problem was. And here was this huge sow, probably weighed 500 pounds, looking down into the kitchen window, because as I reported earlier, there was no foundation on the house and it had sunk, and we'd hauled rock into the driveway so we wouldn't get stuck. So the driveway was quite a bit higher than the kitchen window, and this big old sow was looking right down at Carol. And she was supposed to farrow that day, and we had a pen all fixed up for her, but she didn't like it and she tore it all apart. She was looking for a better home for her babies. And so that was one of Carol's many experiences as a farm wife in Lakeview.
Yeah.
She didn't know what it was, did she? She didn't know what it was.
She'd never seen anything that big.
She said the closest she ever got to a pig was in the deli and back in New York. She didn't know pigs come with four legs.
Yeah. So where did you live in New York City?
We lived out in, when I first got there, I lived in a place called Soldiers, Sailors, and Airmen's Club on Lexington Avenue in New York City itself. And we were stationed down at I think it's exactly the site where the World Trade Center was built. This is in the 50s. And we were in a dairy, a cheese market there, and inspected cheese and butter that was sold to the Army or was government-owned and was transferred to the Army, and we had to do quality and taste tests and whatnot. And then after we got married, we moved out into a little place called Middle Village, which was in the edge of Queens, between Queens and Long Island. I couldn't figure out what the name implied until we moved out there and found out it was a little two-block-wide area with apartments surrounded by cemeteries. Hmm. And so you caught a bus and walked into this area, and when you were leaving, you walked out and caught a bus and rode it to a subway, and it took just about an hour and 45 minutes to get to downtown Manhattan from out there, but we were in the suburbs of New York City.
Yeah. How did you meet your wife?
She was a hostess at the Soldiers, Sailors, and Airmen's Club. And I was not acting. I was doing the real Harold thing. I was very shy and standing on the staircase looking out over the dancers and wondering how I fit into this. And a friend of Carol's come and got me and said, we need to dance. And so we're dancing, and she dances me over next to Carol, and Carol was dancing with a paratrooper, a Green Beret. And she said to me, she said, you need to dance with her. And I said, okay. And I turned and said, excuse me, and kind of bumped the paratrooper out of the way and started dancing with her. And it turned out that Carol had signaled her friend that this guy was coming on too strong and she wanted out of it. And so I was the hero and took her home that night. And we dated city ever after that until we got married 14 months later.
Yeah. So what was it like for you? In New York City, and then for her coming back into the country.
Well, I love New York City. We had passes to all the Broadway shows and saw every new show that came to Radio City Music Hall because we knew where these passes were available for the soldiers coming back from overseas, and we got there first and got the pick of them. And I guess I won't say I liked it because I knew I didn't have to stay there. I was going home.
Yeah.
When Carol got to Lakeview, she did a lot of crying because I got a job driving truck for my father, and so I was gone 3 nights a week hauling wheat to Portland and San Francisco, and she just was kind of lonely, didn't have a driver's license, couldn't drive, didn't know how to drive, and so she just waited there at this old farmhouse until I got home. And she said she had a number of meetings with herself and decided that she'd got herself into this and she was going to stick it out.
Yeah.
So she's still there.
So you were working on the farm with your father, but you were driving?
That was part of the farm work, was hauling wheat to Portland and bringing back whatever we could find, scrap lumber, new lumber, any way to make a return load.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did from November till the next fall, through that almost through a year. And I guess I'll go ahead and tell this story. We were harvesting the last field of wheat, and Dad had ridden in with me on the truck, and we didn't have a lift. We had to shovel the wheat out of the truck, and so I'm shoveling the wheat, and thinking to myself, I've never gotten a compliment from my father in all my life, and so it might be kind of nice to hear what he has to say. And that's my thought, is I'm finally getting the last of the wheat out the back, and he's just sitting up on the cab watching me, and he clears his throat, and so anticipating what I thought he was going to say, he clears his throat and says, you know, he said, you're going to have to get another job. I can't afford to pay you $250 a month through this next winter, because he hadn't paid us that first winter. We'd lived off the money we'd saved in the Army, which is pretty hard to do, but we had saved a little money, and so that was how we got through that first winter. And so looking back on it, you know, he was a lot smarter than I ever gave him credit for, because he knew there wasn't a great future there on that farm for two families, and that I had an opportunity to do something else. So I went to town and saw my county agent, Elgin Cornett, and said, Elgin, I need a job.
This was the extension?
The county agent there in Lakeview. And it just happened that Carol's mother and her new husband were out visiting us from New York City to see our baby daughter, who was a month old. And so Elgin called Corvallis and talked to Charlie Smith, who I had taken Charlie Smith's class in Extension Methods, which is the same class that Glenn Klein taught later. And so Charlie knew me and said, well, you get here at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And he said, it might've been a day after that, because this was in the afternoon. Yeah, I think it was the next morning. And he said, we'll get you an interview with Frank Ballard. And I said, okay. And so I turned to my stepfather-in-law and said, we need to leave about 2:30 in the morning if we're going to get to Corvallis by 8 in the morning. And he said, okay. Yeah, I don't know whether we want to go on with this, do we? Or you want to take a break there and get to Tommy's Army stuff?
Why don't you finish this story with your...
My interview?
Your interview, yeah.
Okay. Well... we arrived in Corvallis, and there was a Chevron station down on Jefferson and 4th Street, and I went in there and put on this horrible suit that I had bought in New York City, never knowing how ugly it was, but it was the only suit and tie I had, so I wore that up to campus and met Charlie Smith, and And Charlie said, "Will you go in and meet Mr. Ballard? And if he thinks you'll work out," he said, "we probably have a spot for you." So I went into what's now still the director of extension's office, although the receptionist had a little room up front. And then Mr. Ballard had this great room in the back of that area, probably a third again as big as the room is now, and totally dark in there. The shades were all pulled, and I couldn't see a thing when I went through the door. And I finally found a couch, sat on the couch, and Mr. Ballard was sitting behind this big desk with sunglasses on. And I thought, well, that was kind of strange. But I'm sitting there thinking, now, I've never been interviewed for a job, but I think they're supposed to ask the questions. So it was seemed like eternity, but I sat there, and he finally said, "Lakeview." And I thought to myself, that's not a question. I said, "Yes, sir." And another long pause, and he says, "Damn good goose hunting down there." And I said to myself, that's still not a question. "Yes, sir," I said. And there was this long pause that seemed like minutes, probably was seconds, but seemed like minutes. And he said, "Why don't you go over to Prineville tomorrow and meet Gus Woods? And if Gus thinks he can get along with you," he said, "we'll put you in Prineville as a 4-H agent." And the only thought I had was, this is not the fellow to ask where Prineville is. So I left the room, and Charlie was standing out in the hall, and he said, how'd it go? And I said, "Well, Mr. Ballard said I should go to Prineville tomorrow and meet Gus Woods." And Charlie said, "I'm sure they had this all set up." But Charlie said, "Yes." And he said, "Be there before 8 o'clock, because," he said, "Gus goes to the office before 8, gets his messages, and if he needs to go up country, which is what they called the eastern part of Crook County, he'll leave before 8 o'clock and you'll miss him." But so we took off for, I didn't even ask Charlie where Prineville was. We took off. I guess we must have gone back over the Willamette Pass. Anyhow, we ended up in Bend and stayed in this little cottage in the edges of Bend. And I think it cost $10 for the night's lodging. Got up the next morning at 5:30, not knowing how far away Prineville was, and drove to Prineville, probably sitting out in front of the courthouse at 6:30. And about 7, saw the lights come on in the extension office, where I thought was the extension office. And so I excused myself. My father-in-law went over, knocked on the window, and they let me in. And it was almost like being interviewed by Frank Ballard again. He said, "You was a 4-H'er, were you?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "You know," he said, "being a 4-H'er is not the same as being a 4-H agent." And I said, "Well, yeah," I said, "I think I can understand that. I knew I had two or three 4-H agents in my career in Lakeview," I said, "and they're all different, but really nice guys," I said. "And yeah," I said, "I think I can understand there is a difference." And he said, "Well, when can you be to work?" And I said, "Well, I've got to take my mother-in-law and her husband back to Reno, because they don't fly, and so I got to catch a train in Reno, and that'd be Wednesday." And I said, "Thursday we'd need to pack up what little we got." And I said, "I could be here Friday morning." He said, "No, Monday would be soon enough." And so that was my introduction to extension work and interviews by my future staff chairman and the director of extension, which were both Gus Woods became my adopted father. He became a real friend, a real supporter, and I met with Mr. Ballard maybe one other time, and he was famous. He'd been director of extension for 44 years and even been president of the university, and every other extension service in the country said he was the best director in the U.S., and I don't think all of Oregon knew that or appreciated it, but nationwide he was very well thought of. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Did you know why he had that reputation? What did he do to gain that reputation?
Oh, I think he had good people around him, and he had an uncanny ability to judge people in a first impression, and was an extremely effective lobbyist with the legislators in Salem, because in those days Extension had to lobby for their own money, and he did that well and was well thought of up there. And it was just, everybody just said he was Mr. Ballard, and there was nobody that was quite his equal, you know. And that was the way he wasn't a great speaker. He had more sense of humor than I first realized after I got a little better acquainted with him. But he just had that ability, I think, having himself surrounded with excellent people.
So I guess you learned where Prineville was.
I found Prineville.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking last night about this, and I'm wondering how I got to Bend, because that isn't the shortest way from Corvallis to Prineville. And the only road I knew over the mountain was the Willamette Pass, so I probably went back to Eugene and went up over the Willamette Pass and then went up to Bend. It's probably how I got there.
Yeah. So what were your feelings when, you had to leave your family ranch?
Oh, I dreamt about somehow or other owning that place someday. Yeah. Even talked to an uncle who had a little money in California about borrowing money from him, and he said, no, you don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he didn't say he wouldn't loan it to me, but he said, you don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It stayed in the family for a while. My younger brother went into service when I got home. Then when he got back to Lakeview, he went to work for the county. And my sister's husband, brother-in-law, had moved back to Lakeview. He had worked for Boeing up in Seattle, and he'd moved back to Lakeview and started a feed store in a gas station. And sold gas and sold feed and livestock supplies out of what used to be the grease room. And he and my father became partners in the trucking business, and they had up to 7 trucks on the road hauling freight from Lakeview out and things back into Lakeview. And then when that kind of broke up with, you know, no hard feelings or anything, it just kind of dissolved itself.
Mm-hmm.
Dad sold the farm, and they moved to Arizona for 6 months of the year, and then spent the summers in Lakeview. And
mm-hmm.
Mom passed away shortly after they did that from cancer. And then my father lived in Lakeview for a while and then spent his later years in Klamath Falls with my two sisters and mm-hmm. that lived in Klamath Falls.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what did Carol think about moving to Prineville?
She thought Prineville was a great step forward from the ranch in Lakeview. She got involved with people there, and the kids, of course, our son was born there, and I guess we were there 9 years, so they started school in Prineville.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one point in time, my supervisor said, you know, Harold, we've gotten to the point where you need a master's degree to stay with the Extension Service and ever get treated right and promoted. And
mm-hmm.
so I said, well, okay, I'd consider that. And so I had the GI Bill, which I hadn't used. And so we packed up the two little kids and Carol and I and borrowed a trailer from Gus Woods and hauled our bigger furniture to Fort Collins, Colorado, and took a course there called... it was in the School of Education, but it was for extension people. It was extension something or other. Ended up with a master's in education.
That was at Colorado State?
At Colorado State at Fort Collins.
Uh-huh.
And a very enjoyable experience. I wrote a thesis on a topic that was very appropriate at the time. Extension administration was looking seriously at dissolving county lines and having area agents across the state, and so I did a survey of the county agents, and I got a 96% response. I developed a questionnaire and tested it on an audience in Colorado and then sent it out to the agents. Got a 96% response from the agents about their attitude. The title of my thesis was Attitude Towards Change.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was measuring was their attitudes towards changing their job as extension workers. Nothing significant except that younger agents saw it as a career improvement, that they could specialize in their subject matter and work across county lines.
Mm-hmm.
The older agents were pretty well opposed to it because they saw a lot of strength in the ties and commitments and connections that Extension had with the county government, where when they provided a substantial amount of financial support. They paid for the office, paid for travel, paid for telephone, secretaries, and all those kinds of things. And they had historically built up a terrific relationship with their county governments wherever they were, particularly places like Gus Woods, who had been there for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of those older agents saw little advantage in it. And I'm not sure, although a number of people in Oregon have read the thesis, and I don't know that it influenced anybody, but it was a very interesting study to do, and And said the people in Colorado couldn't believe that I got that kind of response from the Oregon agents, but they really have filled out the form completely. I remember one old county agent who I won't name, he said, this is one of the dumbest ideas Extension has ever had, and he just wrote that across the top of the questionnaire, and that's all he said. But I didn't count that one as a legitimate response. But anyhow, that then set me up so that I could be considered for other jobs, and I was offered, as Tommy will tell later, I was offered a job in Gillum County as an ag agent and 4-H agent. And that was before I decided to go get my master's, or I was just in the process. And so I turned that down. And when I got back, I was 3 or 4 months, I was offered a job in Heppner. Well, I had never been to Heppner, didn't have a clue where it was. Knew that it was mostly a wheat job and didn't know exactly very much about wheat, having been an animal science major, but thought I could do it, and turned out to be a terrific career decision and a job I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get to Heppner,
okay,
why don't you talk a little bit about, you talked about in your thesis, this the close relationship between agents and farmers and so forth. What exactly, what was your position then in Prineville?
In Prineville, I was known, even though all agents had the same title, County Extension Agent, I was known as the 4-H agent. And so that was my major responsibility. I was responsible for the weed control program that the county ran. I purchased the chemicals, supervised the actual spraying of the county roads, and enjoyed that experience. Did that same thing up in Morrill County. Gus made a real effort to involve me in a lot of the beef extension work he did. That was his specialty, and we had a lot of large ranchers up country in the Palina country, and a number of registered herds there in the Powell Butte, Prineville area, and they were on what they called production testing, where we'd weigh the calves and grade them, and then often help select the bulls that they needed to buy to replace their herd bulls as they needed to do that. So I got involved in quite a bit of the beef work, which I enjoyed because that was where my training was.
Mm-hmm.
I need to go back and talk about my first week on the job as a 4-H agent in Prineville.
Okay.
Got there Monday morning, and Gus Woods, oh, by the way, my mother-in-law loaned me $60 to pay the first month's rent on the motel where we moved into. Mm-hmm. We lived in a motel for 6 months in Prineville. And so, anyhow, I went to work Monday morning, and everything was all new, of course, and I'm getting acquainted with what the process was. And Gus said, well, ride out to the radio station with me at noon. And he did a Monday noon radio program, and it was a high listening time because it was called Farm News, and they had national speakers on tape and often guest speakers from Department of Agriculture. And anyhow, Gus did this live 7-minute program every Monday, and he did his thing about what was going on in the beef industry and turned to me and said, well, we have a new county agent here. His name is Harold Kerr, and I'll let him introduce himself. And he slid that mic over to me, and I know my lips moved, my mouth moved, but nothing came out. He grinned and pulled the mic back in front of him and said, well, he's a little shy, but he'll be on Saturday morning to tell you more about himself and the program. And so, man, I thought. And then on the way back to town, the radio station is about 5 miles out of town, and he said, well, you do a 15-minute live program on Saturday mornings. And I said, ooh, okay. So I spent a good part of that week preparing a 15-minute radio program, having never done one, had written it all out, had read it to myself, and then read it out loud, and had got everything pretty well organized, except that I'd never timed myself. Mm-hmm. And so I get to the radio station that Saturday morning, and Bob Arnott was the local radio announcer, and he said, well, we have a new man here this morning. He said, we'll let him introduce himself and tell you all about himself. And I had prepared that part, and I had that and read it, and did a little bit about what my expectations were of the job and what was happening that next week or so, and got down to the bottom of my script, and I looked at my watch, and I'd been talking for 7 minutes, and I had 8 more to go. And I looked at Bob Arnott with horror, I guess, and he said, well, we'll just play a couple Western tunes for Harold, and he'll be on for 15 minutes next week. So that was my introduction to radio. I thought afterwards, I wonder why Charlie Smith didn't make that as part of that extension methods class, because a lot of agents did radio programming in those days. And KRCO was it sat on an alkali flat, which the locals said was improved the radio reception, had a tower, and you could get it almost to Lakeview and almost to the Columbia River. Mm-hmm. I mean, it reached a big area of eastern Oregon. So I learned later that my audience wasn't just Crook County, that I was talking to people for over six or seven or eight counties. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, that was, it turned out that I got, so I could do that 15 minutes, totally ad lib, no notes, no preparation, just get out my calendar and see what was happening and start talking. Mm-hmm. And so it became kind of fun to do each mm-hmm. Saturday. I had to schedule my life so that I wasn't in town on Saturday morning, because that was a live show. They didn't mm-hmm. want it taped.
And you also played some of your own music?
I did. I learned how to run the table and whatnot, because the fellow that was in charge, he'd take a break and he'd go have coffee, or he'd be in the restroom or something when my 15 minutes was up. And so I'd just walk around the corner and say, well, I'll play a new tune that I just found here today. And I'd put mm-hmm. on a record and play it. And I guess I should tell about Mr. Hutton, who was the state 4-H leader at the time. One Saturday morning, he was driving from Burns to Bend and picked up my radio program. And it turned out that that one was probably one of our better ones, because Bob Arnon had been our guest up at our Tri-County 4-H camp up in the Ochocos for the evening and stayed for the evening program and whatnot. And he was really impressed with what we were doing with the 4-Hers up there. And by the way, that was a 2-week camp. We took the 9 through 12-year-olds the first week, and then the older kids up the second week. And we had counselors for both weeks, but the staff, the faculty stayed both weeks. And we, for quite a few years, we didn't have showers. We had to bathe in over a basin, which often had ice on it in the morning. So we kind of roughed it. But
this anyhow, was a statewide camp?
No, a three-county camp.
Crook,
Deschutes, and Jefferson County.
Okay.
And so anyhow, Bob was really impressed, and he was asking a lot of questions, and I was talking with enthusiasm about the camp, and of course we had some stories to share. And when they got through, Bob had left the room, and so I went in to turn on, play some music, and the phone rang, and Mr. Hutton called and said, I'm on the road between Burns and Bend. He said, I've been listening to your program. He said, you sure have a lot of fun there on that radio station. And I said, well, Mr. Hutton, I said, you know, if life's not worth having fun, then life's not worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether he intended to criticize me or not, but he never did. And I never expected the 4-H leader, state 4-H leader, to be listening to my radio program.
Yeah, but, what were some of the other activities with the 4-H students?
Well, I think you'd have to call me an old-fashioned 4-H agent. Mm-hmm. I felt pretty strongly that I should support the leaders and go to as many 4-H meetings, individual meetings, as I could. So the Powell Butte community has a community school, which is still there, and it was available to 4-Hers every night of the week if we wanted it. And in the cafeteria, there were usually activities upstairs, but we could have the cafeteria. And we had almost had a meeting there every night. So sometimes I'd not know which group was going to be meeting there, but I'd drive out to Powell Butte, which is about 12, 13 miles away, and there'd be a 4-H group there, and I'd contribute something to the meeting, and mm-hmm. always felt good about doing that. Had a couple leaders that wouldn't meet without me, mm-hmm. so I had to go to all their meetings.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally unheard of now, and probably wasn't necessary, but it gave me a direct contact with the kids, and I valued that very strongly. Another thing that I did that I don't know of any, well, I've have heard a few 4-H agents tell about doing this. We had a portable scales, and the kids, when they buy steers to raise for 4-H, particularly nowadays, but even then, made a substantial financial investment in that animal and the feed, to feed it for 8 months to get it ready for the show. And so we instituted a program where we weighed every steer in the county every month. We had three 4-H beef clubs, one in Powell Butte, one in Prineville, and one up in Palina. And so it took three Saturdays a month to get those steers all weighed. And that was from January through July. And of course, I had to do the radio program anyhow Saturday morning. And so that was And if I only had one rule, that a leader had to go with me, or if not a leader, a parent, so that I wasn't doing it totally by myself. But mm-hmm. we helped kids break their steers to lead, because it's often that was the first time they'd had a halter on them when we showed mm-hmm. up to weigh them. And was another real good experience for me, and I think the kids appreciated it. And put a lot of miles on that state car pulling those scales all over the county. Mm-hmm.
Tom talked to us before about his experience with the International Farm Youth Exchange.
Right.
And
well, as a 4-H agent, I had the other side of it. He talked a little bit about I was a host then for the IFEs, as we called them, that were coming back from overseas. And they were always outstanding young college students to be selected to that honor. And it was always a real treat to host them. And I'd let the people in Corvallis know that I wanted to host an IFE. And for many years, it was four every year. And I didn't get all four, but I got one of the four. Because mm-hmm. then they tried to go to every county in the state. And so that meant that the people that I had had probably been to seven or eight counties by the time they got in their reporting history. Mm-hmm. And they were just neat young people, both men and women, and had terrific experiences. And New Zealand, where Glenn had, and Australia, and Scandinavian countries, and France, and Turkey. I remember one time we had a young man who had been to Australia, and he said he was from Willamette Valley, and he said, I told the Australian farmers that there wasn't any gates like they have in Australia and in Oregon. And what it was just a wire attached to a pole, and you just hooked it over the barbed wire on the gate and wrapped it around behind this pole, and there wasn't anything to it fancy, but he said, I had never seen one of those in Oregon. And we took an indirect route back to Prineville from Palina and had to go on a private road and had to go through one of these gates. And we stopped, and he said, I'll get it. And he got out, and he came back. He had this funny look on his face, and he said, I told those Australians we didn't have any gates like that in Oregon. So anyhow, it was just a terrific experience, and the schools were very, service clubs enjoyed having them, but the schools just insisted that they get a chance for their kids to be exposed to this kind of an activity. Mm-hmm. Tommy, we've been rambling on. We've been through the Army and through Crook County,
and
so it's kind of your turn now.
Yeah. Well, I think before, this might be a place to, I have one more question before we
okay.
take a break. So looking back at your first, was it 9 years?
9 years.
In Prineville, what do you think, what was the most satisfying part of your work there?
Oh, I think I realized it later. When I started meeting these kids that were in 4-H and they're young parents now, or in some cases even grandparents, and have them come up to me at State Fair or see me here on campus and make some real positive comment about the influence I had on their lives. Mm-hmm. And at the time when, you know, the young people wouldn't tell you that when they're a 7th, 8th grader, and I probably didn't appreciate that I was having that kind of influence on them, but I think the feedback I got from kids and their parents, I remember one time we met, and we were in Sisters having dinner, and this family came in, and it was a daughter and mother and father, and she was in 4-H in Powell Butte, and she had three neighbor girls who lived right across the road from her. The four of them were my livestock judging team one year at the PI, and they just were exceptional young ladies. And she sat there and told me how much it meant to her for me to think about helping her and assisting her in a number of ways, she said. And I had just thought she was just an outstanding young lady, was a heck of a good livestock judge, and mm-hmm. hadn't realized about any other impact I might have made on her.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this was during the 60s, too.
Yes.
When you think of everything.
I missed the 60s. Our world didn't include what everybody else was doing. We weren't worried about drugs. We weren't worried about protesting war. We were just growing up and having fun raising animals and being farm kids.
Okay. That was the 60s.
Yeah.
You were supposed to be adult then.
Yeah, but I'd like to be like the kids.
That hadn't changed.
Okay, so
thanks,
this is
Ruth.
The end of part two then, and we'll go ahead and take a break.